Okay, let's try to finish this and get trying to make things hopefully a bit more transparent. If you don't understand something, please ask. I will try to answer until I'm much more exhausted than I'm at present. So, first of all, I discussed this situation where you have a stimulus space 2D that extends to infinity left and right and has finite support in the y direction, and and map this onto a one-dimensional model cortex, so the line, the real axis. As the simplest model of a dimension reduction, dimension reducing map. So maybe it would be good to have this a bit more neuronal and concrete. So there are two qualitatively different arrangements for such a map. Such a map will be given by the mapping of all the neurons on this line at position x. Where is their feature vector in this 2D space? R is now a 2D vector of a scalar argument, a mapping of the line into R2. Now there may be, it is useful to distinguish two different kinds of such maps. For example, one in which this R of x meanders up and down in the stimulus space, as opposed to a situation in which it's a straight line. And the reason is, okay, according to our rule, the activated neuron, if I choose some stimulus, the neuron activated is the one neuron with its pointer closest to the stimulus. Now for concreteness, let's have the following coordinates here. Let's call this the position on the, say, on the retina. We have a 1D retina and code the position into that feature space dimension. Or even better, let's have two one-dimensional retinas and let's code into this y direction a positive value if retina number one has a higher level of excitation, and a negative value if retina number two has a higher level of excitation. So like the different average excitation in the both retinas. So this would be measure of the degree to which one eye dominates stimulus, and this is says you where on the retina is the stimulus located. Then in this map, whether you are up or down, it does not matter. A stimulus dominated by the upper retina or by the lower retina, both of them produce an activity bump at the same position. Now in this situation, this is very different. For example, a stimulus up here and down here, this one will activate, let's say, this neuron, but this one, which has the same position on the retina, but the activity is sitting on the other, in the other eye, is mapped here and causes an activity here. So this is the most simple model of ocular dominance columns. The stimuli dominated by the upper retina are mapped into this region, which is a retina 1 region, and those living on the other retina are mapped into this region. So these are a pair of adjacent ocular dominance columns using this analogy. Whereas here we have a perfectly aligned retinotopy in the both eyes, but cannot distinguish in which eye the stimulus was primarily present. Now this is actually a solution of the dynamic equation due to symmetry, because we assume that there's an equal probability of stimuli in the upper and in the lower part of this feature space.
So the line which the, low, the lower line which you draw is actually the set of receptive field centers of the cell.
Yeah.
Because you use the fact that the stimuli and the receptive fields are defined on the same space. And you draw, actually put the neurons on the input, on the space of the input.
Mm-hmm. So that's this line. I go through the cortex and trace where these 2D receptive fields centers are located. Now this is a stationary mapping. And the question I would like to discuss is whether it is also stable. It may be that when you slightly perturb it from this perfect retinotopic state, these stimuli start to draw the perturbation up, and those stimuli start to draw it down, and the other stimuli have no chance to balance the action of these guys. So the thing may be unstable and may, by the learning rule, transform this into this. If this situation is unstable, something like this will form instead. Now to discuss this, we have to linearize the dynamic equation for this curve in the vicinity of the homogeneous state, of the state in which there is no deviation. And to do so, to this end, it's very useful to go from this Cartesian stimulus coordinates to stimulus coordinates x star and delta, where x star is the neuron that maps onto the stimulus onto which the stimulus is mapped, and delta describes the distance, is a measure of the distance between the actual receptive fields and the present stimulus. So this, you can, for small deviations, we wrote this down, this coordinate transform, and which gives this integral differential equation for the map R of x. So this is a 2D vector, and this is a 2D vector, and this is also a 2D vector. The delta is, and it goes from minus to plus infinity.
It's not small, it's just the change in variable from S to delta, or no?
From SX and XY, SY, we go over to X star and delta. So, and because I want to know whether this kind of deviation will increase, so the object of primary interest is a deviation in the y direction. So let's write R of x as the homogeneous solution. This is this vector plus a small deviation, small r. Now, if you put this in here, okay, let's be a bit. So this is stationary. We get what is it? This Jacobian has zero on the off diagonal, so we only need to evaluate the diagonal elements. And they are, what are they? 1 minus to simplify things even further, let's look at a displacement that is only a y contribution. You can do the entire thing and the results will be the same. So in that case, this factor drops out as well. And this capital R is a small r of y, ry of x. And because this is a small quantity and the this absolute value is a thing that's close to 1. So what other terms are there? This is okay. S x Okay, I should not waste my time with this and give you the final result. Huh? Okay, if you plug in the S and R here, you will first of all find that there is, when you integrate, you can do the delta integral and you will only find linear contributions, which means that either this is linearly stable, this state, or the instability will grow until this mapping condition is no longer fulfilled into a state in which there's this coordinate transform does not is not no longer valid. And the resulting dynamic equation for the y deviation then is has this first decay term, which stems from this, this, and this. S in the integral. Okay, this is now this is a okay. This S is the is a function of x star and delta. This is going down. And this term gives you an integral operator that convolutes the second derivative of the deviation with this activity hump. Now the question is whether a small deviation r of y will grow or will decay. What? Okay, this is the decay term, which is purely local. Okay. If this were not present, every deviation would decay. And there's a second term which we have to analyze in order to. Okay, this is the variance of the y component of the stimulus density. And so this is the second derivative of the deviation, and this is our activity bubble, E of R.
The argument of R double prime,
is
that really a Y?
Oh, it's not a Y, that's a X prime. So. Okay, so to discuss this, to see this more clearly, let's consider the Fourier transform of this. So there's a minus 1. The integral is over all x from minus infinity to infinity. And this, since this is a convolution, it will become a product in Fourier representation. The prefactor is kept. We acquire an additional 2 pi square root of that. The Fourier transform of the second derivative of R is minus k square times the Fourier transform of R, and we have the Fourier transform of E, which is the Gaussian, so times R tilde y of k. Now what? So this is the growth rate of mode k. If this, let's call it lowercase lambda of k, all these Fourier modes decouple because of the translation symmetry, and either lambda of k is negative, which means that this mode deviation, that this Fourier mode of a deviation will decay to zero, or lambda of k is positive, then it will increase. Now let's sketch how this spectrum of growth rate looks like. So it's at k equals zero, it's minus one, and at k going to infinity, it's asymptotically minus one, so the very high spatial frequency deviations will decay, and the very low spatial frequency deviations will decay. And in between, there's a hump that is proportional to k square e to the minus k square sigma square over 2. So how does this is a thing that looks like this. Now, depending on this prefactor.
What?
The positive sign. Okay, here's the second derivative. Gives you a minus k square. Here's this k square, and there went the minus sign. Okay, what is the size of this hump? This is proportional to Sy variance times this. Now let's introduce an additional sigma square here, so such that this is a function whose magnitude does not change, and compensated by another sigma square there. So you can make this hump grow by either increasing the variance of the stimulus ensemble in the y direction, in the ignore direction, or by decreasing the sigma. Both of them will make this function, so making sigma larger will shift the function to the right, and either making s larger or making sigma smaller will increase its magnitude, such that there is, for given s, a critical sigma for which, such that for sigma smaller than this critical value, the deviation will grow, but only for wave numbers around the typical wave number. So this phenomenon is widely called a Turing instability, because it is Turing was the first mathematician to study a similar equation, and the characteristic feature of a Turing instability is that it has a single maximum at the non-vanishing k value, which corresponds to a typical spacing of the within the structure that will emerge. And so let's, if there are no questions here, I could demonstrate this instability to you in a small simulation and then go on to apply it in a defined model. Okay, let's have this. Das wäre nett. An intuitive explanation for this. Oh, okay. Okay, if you have a very large sigma, okay, and consider the action of the individual stimulus. So this is in the end what happens. You bombard this thing with stimulus and make little deformations. They are very shallow for a large sigma because they are multiplied with this broad Gaussian. To get a runaway situation, the deviations the stimuli impose onto this pattern should be such that they are on the order of the size of the box. That's the intuitive picture.
Okay, but the idea being that if one of these points in the center moves up.
Yeah.
It starts to specialize to all the points.
Yeah.
On that side, and then that pushes away, that competition pushes away the neighboring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it eats up the stimuli that kept the other people in place. No signal. What is the source? So this is about the model we discussed. It is now on a finite mapping, 2D square, which is the unit length in this direction and 0.4 units in the y direction onto a unit interval. And this fat line is just the line of all the receptive field centers when you go through the cortex and track those in the stimulus space. Now this is a stationary state or something close to it for a large value of sigma, 0.2 of the entire length. And so in the next step, I decrease the sigma close to the critical value, but just above. So what we'll see, hopefully, is that there are long-living perturbations of this state that are on the size of which is on the order of the sigma. And when you go a bit below the critical parameter, those deviations will start to grow because they now acquire an eigenvalue that is larger than 1 and end up in a wiggly curve, which so makes neurons selective only for upper part stimuli or only for lower part stimuli in this abstract feature space. Okay. What?
The width of the
wavelength. the wavelength is on the order 4 times sigma. So
it scales with sigma.
Scales with sigma, but it's not...
But the analytical calculation is only for small...
Yeah.
For sigma close to...
For small deviations.
Transition point.
Yeah. The transition is first order in any event, so it gives you little knowledge about the event. It gives you just a rough sketch, a rough guess for the wavelength.
And you can analyze the instability only for small sigma.
Yeah.
Or finite sigma. To derive a differential
equation. No, the sigma is arbitrary, but the linear approximation is valid only for small deviations, and there's no solution close to them because it's a first order. It's a jump to another.
But I thought you had to use small sigma to get the differential.
No, that was this other calculation.
Here
it's integral equation from
the
equation. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Why is it first order?
It happens to be. Yeah. The reason is that there is no if you write down this equation, there are no higher order terms as long as this this tangential mapping is valid, but it is valid for small for any small perturbation of the state, so there can be no stabilizing term for a small perturbation. So it can't be second order, that's the result. So
but the point is,
it must be first order.
This
yes.
is the condition for instability of the uniform, of the straight
yeah.
state. But the this undulated state could have appeared before.
Yeah, and that's that probably there.
That's why it's first order.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying there.
Mm-hmm.
Could it be that you have two stable?
Yeah,
it's
implied. Probably it's bistable. There's a coexistence regime. So, but okay.
You cannot compute this
second. Yeah.
You cannot compute this second solution.
I know. I don't know a simple way. You can solve the equations if you are careful enough numerically. Okay, so let's get back to the brain. Since we are close to the ocean, I would like to remind you that there are pinwheels all over the world. It's okay, now is the day, flip it twice. No, that's wrong. Right? Okay, I go behind the screen, so. This is the somatosensory cortex of the Earth, and here's the visual cortex. It's connected, and it has as far as I can count 12 pinwheels. So here's one, there's one, there's one, there's one, and the stimulus is now not really the visual image on the retina, but it's rather the position of the moon. So these lines of equal color, so this is also in the graphic data. And what they map is the time at which the tide has its high point. So this is a cyclic variable. For every point in the ocean, you can say at that time, tide has its high point, and there is a 1D manifold across the ocean, a line across the ocean where all the points have the same at the same time their high point tide. And funny enough, there are discontinuities, point defects, where all these tide lines meet, and those are just places where a block of water is swirling around, so they have same sea level, whatever the position of the moon, and the tide is going around them. Obviously, this is for the existence of the somatosensory cortex. Otherwise, the water would just travel around the Earth. David, what do you find?
It's
here? Yeah? So, which means that it is to whenever you have a phase variable mapped on a 2D on a 2D manifold, for example, the surface of the Earth, it is very natural to get these point defects in the phase variable. Yeah, a cyclic variable. It's 2 to 2. Yeah. I mean, okay, 1D to 2D. Yeah.
But opposite to what you said there.
If you like. The essential point is that this is a cyclic variable, that you map the 2D onto a circle. A circle onto 2D.
I don't know, I might hit that signal.
Okay. What?
You can predict 16 wheels that you can talk in London.
So, okay, let's go back to this other brain where composed of neurons. In the next part or so, I would like to come back to concrete patterns, occult dominance and orientation preference. And so I mentioned these two levels. Of course, we all believe that finally the basic description is on this microscopic level of synaptic plasticity, but the transparent and tractable description is probably at a higher level where we have a much more compact description of the patterns. And the first thing I like to do is to exhibit an example of how such a high level description can be derived from a synaptic dynamics and what we may learn by this. So in the following two maps play a role, orientation and occult dominance. As I said, the orientation map can be described by a complex order parameter field where the phase describes the angle of the preferred stimulus orientation, and the modulus is some measure of the selectivity of a given column. The occult dominance pattern is even more easy to describe. To know the pattern of occult dominances, it's enough for every position in the cortex to know some number, and let's stick to the convention that number larger than zero means left eye columns, number smaller than zero means right eye columns, and this gives you also the opportunity to code degrees of eye dominance, stronger and weaker eye dominance. So much of the, almost all of the models for the formation of occult dominance columns have been motivated by these observations made almost more than 20 years ago, which are outdated. I come to that point in the end of this lecture. But for a long time, people believed that occult dominance columns form in a continuous segregation process that takes quite a while. So these are images of occult dominance columns obtained from a cortex cut perpendicular to the cortical surface, taken at different points in time, and days is days after birth. So this is from an animal that was investigated 15 days after birth, and this is taken from an animal that was investigated like 3 months after birth. And you see that this pattern becomes gradually more and more discernible, from which people concluded that at the early stage, this system consists of a visual cortex in which the afferents from the two eyes completely overlap and then gradually segregate into alternating patches where either one eye gets a lot of provides a lot of input and the other not, and vice versa. The nice thing about this story is that this period where this pattern becoming more crisp was observed is exactly the period where the plasticity of the synapses and of these connections is largest. We'll have to talk about this interpretation later. It is no longer very convincing by now, but this kind of observation forms the rationale for many ocular dominance conformation models. Yes?
I mean, maybe it's just a detail, but what? I mean, the gradualness is because I look at 22 days and I already see upper dominance patterns, and I look at 39 days, and, you know, just because it's. Is there a reason why, at least from the data, 22 days, it looks like it's sort of being formed on one side of the fold?
You mean this difference, whether this has a meaning?
Yeah, I mean, because you said it's being formed gradually, but it's sort of embarrassing. I've seen this data before, I never looked at it so carefully. It looks like it's well formed in one part of the visual system and not well formed in the other part.
Oh, that's.
From a model point of view, it's kind of important, rather.
Yeah. But it's this is wrong anyway, so it will. My suspicion is that this is okay. One should look at different instances and see whether there's a pattern.
Proline.
This is proline.
It's wrong because now there's a claim from Larry Cass that the proline crosses.
Antonella Antonini has re-evaluated her data from Kitten and finds that she has a clustering of this arbors very, very earlier than 15. So, okay, there's one thing different. This is Cat, and Larry looks at ferrets, which might be an important difference. But also in the Cat, there's accumulating evidence that these columns are there before. I mean, the other observation is by Kerr's optical imaging data, who also at this point finds physiological ocular dominance columns, regions of larger and smaller eye dominance that have about the same periodicity.
So this is a classic result that might be wrong.
Yes. Yeah.
So you think the whole point is that if only at the 22-day data on the left-hand side that's overexposed, then they would have come to rather different conclusions. So they could have overexposed their film.
Yeah.
No, but the claim was that also even before 15 days, there might be.
Yeah.
And even before 15 days, people were reporting.
Indeed. Okay. I prepared some. I would like to discuss this evidence later first, but yeah, there are probably both differences in so between truth and this, and between truth and different species. So and one question we in particular were puzzled when we started to investigate such models was. The question whether experience can actually change the wavelength of the pattern, and there is some evidence that this is feasible in the cat, possible in the cat. These are two ocular dominance maps obtained by Proline by Siegfried Löwel, like 6 years ago, and she found that systematically in the kitten she raised with squint. The ocular dominance columns were larger and had a larger spacing as compared to the normal kittens. And with a quantitative analysis, she found that the smallest columns in the squinting animals were still larger than the largest columns she observed in a normal in an animal with normal visual experience. Yeah.
Just a question about terminology, but why is that called squint? Does someone know why? When I think of squint, I don't think of that.
Cross eye, I mean, the term is strabismus, yeah. Yeah, that's widespread use. Maybe Germans introduced it because they don't know what squint is. So. Okay, let's make it clear what we mean by this term. Is there a Frenchman? Yeah. Both the wavelength and the size. So this is meant by the term squint. Let's define it by this picture. And it's exactly how this kitten look. They have one eye pointing to the side.
That's Sarge.
Yeah, who?
Sarge.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
100 points. Right. And I would like to present this work because it is an example of how to go from micro level to macroscopic level. So let's start with a Hapgood learning rule that is modified by a synaptic decay term such that we get the weight analogous equation for synaptic weights as we had discussed for this abstract feature space dimensions. So, okay, what we look at is the projection of some peripheral area in which there are activity patterns A of R. A is the activity of peripheral neurons located at position R in the peripheral sheet. And they are connected to neurons in the target layer. And we denote the strength of connections to a neuron located at X in the target layer, say the visual cortex, by the weights W of R and X. Now what is happening is that as when an activity pattern in the peripheral sheet is excited, it is projected, it projects this activity by means of its synapses into the target layer, resulting in some activity pattern in the target layer. And okay, the simplest Hapgood assumption is that the rate of change, or the change in the synaptic connection between R and X, is proportional both to the presynaptic and the postsynaptic activity. Now this is a positive number, so that weights will always decrease and grow forever. So there must be, in any realistic learning rule, another term that keeps them from growing to infinity. And a simple choice is to have a weight decay, you know, the weights decay, in proportion to the activity of the neurons.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, because I keep this old idealization simplification that there's a stereotyped activity pattern E of whatever is in the is the argument, and the only thing that differs between different for different stimuli is the position of the center neuron.
So this is translational invariant connection.
Yeah. That's the idea, is that there's a translation invariant connection and a strong.
And A always have the same shape. The input part has exactly the same shape.
Need not.
But if they have different shape, then the shape of.
Then this idealization becomes more questionable. But you can study the model.
To make some correspondence.
Yeah?
This and the abstract feature. This is only identical if A has the same shape. And W is translation invariant.
Then there's the mapping is exact. Mm-hmm. Okay, down here we stated is this simplifying assumption of a Gaussian-shaped activity hump in the target layer. Now to model ocular dominance column formation, the simplest thing one needs to consider is the mapping not of one but of two. Yeah.
I just know. What's X zero really? I can't really visualize that. So I could coming from
Okay, I did not define what X0 is. It is the center of the activity. And let's define later which point this really should be.
But that depends on the stimulus.
Yeah, it is stimulus dependent, but let's make this dependence explicit at a later point.
So why does the A of R depend on stimulus?
A of what? This is the stimulus. This is the activity pattern in the right eye. This is the activity pattern in the left eye, say. So it is the stimulus.
So X0 would be the peak for that particular stimulus?
Yes. Now we have connections from the left and the right eye, and can define an ocular dominance field in terms of these connections. So the simple choice being that you have this field O of X, the total synaptic strength that feeds into the target at X from the left eye minus the total synaptic strength that feeds into the target from the right eye. This will be a positive number if the left eye connection is totally stronger, and it will be a negative number if the right eye connection is totally stronger. Now, because this is a linear functional of the W's, the equation for the change in O has just the same form, the same structure as the equation for the change in the W's. So to derive this, you have to plug in the delta W here and the delta W left here and the delta W right here. And then you can do the integral and finding on the one hand side this O of X field and S0 now is the total activity in the left eye minus the total activity in the right eye. Yes. And in the same sense as before, we should look at the continuous time dynamics for epsilon small and a large number of activity patterns impinging on the system. Continuous time dynamics, which is the right hand side of which is given by the stimulus average of this term. Now for symmetry between left and right eye, if exchanging the activity patterns in the left and right eye leave the system, the density of those things invariant, we already know one stationary solution is the solution without eye dominance, and can look at the linearization of this equation. I have to define what X star is.
So property of the input.
So this is a subsection of transparencies that seems not to have all the equations needed. So with these two activity patterns, activity AL in the left eye, activity AR in the right eye, let's define S0 as the total activity in the left eye minus the total activity in the right eye, using a common coordinate frame in the two eyes, that is the retinotopic corresponding positions. Now this will be larger than zero if the left eye activity is larger, and smaller than zero if the right eye activity is larger. And as mentioned, what is missing is the dependence of the activity center on the present stimulus. The left and the right.
X0
in the previous. Yeah. X0. In principle, you need to know all the activity patterns in order to determine it. So, but for reasons of practicality, let's have x0 only depend on this total activity number. By such a choice, whenever x0 is only a function of this effective stimulus coordinate, this becomes a closed equation in which the synaptic strengths don't.
WL is equal to AL times E.
W what?
Definition of WL again. WL is equal to.
WL is a synaptic strength. It's just a number.
The delta WL is A times.
Yeah. Okay. This is x naught is a functional of two activity patterns: the activity pattern in the left eye, the activity pattern in the right eye. Now, if we define it like this, this is in principle in a general model of okay. Now, to simplify things, what is the most simple model for this dependence of x naught on the activity on the stimulus?
You don't take zero from the rate matrices as you normally do.
Yeah.
You just say, so the meaning of the rate matrix is not for you to know. You don't compute the dot product of the input activity with the rate matrix determines the output. You just say, you. Right.
Yeah, this is a hand-waving simplification of the high-dimensional problem. So if you assume, okay, it's an assumption, a hypothesis, that once you know as not, you know which neuron, this equation is closed. So it depends only on the statistics of the S, and no longer on the statistics of the A's.
But if the weights don't determine the output, then why do you call them the
statistics? I mean, still, so for example, I mean, a plausible choice, of course, is to have a neuron in which the receptive fields of the neuron as the center position of its weight matrix is close to the position of the stimulus, in defined as the center of gravity of the stimulus of the A. And in addition, require that the ocular dominance of the neuron should be close to the I that dominates in the stimulus. So this depends on x, this depends on x, and there's one x naught that minimizes this, and that's a simple assumption that closes this dynamics and leaves you motivated by synaptic dynamics with a field equation for the O of x. Which is often.
Yeah, I'm still not even getting stuck in where this equation comes from. So
which one?
Delta O of x.
Delta O of x. It comes.
Delta O of x should be the integral of delta W.
Yeah. So this is the equation for the delta W. Now.
So S zero comes from the delta of the first term. Is that right?
Yes. And O comes from the W. In the second term.
So this is the exact equation. The second equation is exact.
Yeah, this is exact. This is exact, but it's averaged over A's. Now, when we make the simplification to have an X naught that depends only on the on these features of the stimulus, you end up with a closed dynamics for the field O of X. And it is the dynamics we just analyzed. So we know. Okay.
So the equation then for S0 is, I can't even read exactly, but on the board is the equation for S0 that closes the O dynamics?
Yeah. For X0, you have receptive field centers of those neurons at X, and you have a center of gravity of the stimuli, of the stimulus. You have ocular dominances of the neurons.
Sorry, what's the difference between S and X0?
What?
S0 is this.
Is the, okay, this is the center of gravity,
okay.
Capital S vector.
So S and S0 have nothing to do with each other?
Yeah, there are different dimensions of this feature space. This is the this is the center of gravity of the stimulus,
okay.
And this is the I dominance measure of the stimulus.
But S is a vector, the center of gravity in the left and the right eyes?
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's one X that minimizes this distance. Let's define it as the, let's work with this as the center of activation.
So then where is X0 inside this equation?
The E of X minus X0.
Yeah.
Yeah.
E of X is.
So it should be E of X minus X0.
Yeah. This is true. Yeah. Okay, they should read like this one. Huh?
What is that equation in words?
What is the equation in words?
So
okay.
The second term is just weight decay.
Yeah, second term.
Rho times E is just weight decay.
And this is the right eye stimuli make the right eye neurons become more right eye, and the left eye stimuli make the left eye neurons become more left eye. But all this may be canceled by the decay of the field. So there's an interplay between this decay of the pattern due to the weight decay. The weight decay makes the decay of the ocular dominance pattern, and the stimuli can increase the ocular dominance that is already there.
So without the weight decay, the difference
will always increase. Just like a Happian rule without constraints or weight decay or sliding thresholds. We already have the solution of this problem. So I don't know whether you remember this perfect binocular solution is the straight line. And now the question of whether an ocular dominance pattern arises from a homogeneous state is again the question of these eigenvalues. And so we already know that in this model, there's a critical size of this activation domain, sigma star, such that if the activation domains are larger than the critical size, the homogeneous state is stable, and ocular dominance counts would disintegrate, decay, and below it, they will spontaneously form, even from a homogeneous situation.
You didn't really prove that, you just proved instability.
What?
What
kind of thing comes out? Okay, but you know that close to the instability point, only modes with around the typical wave vector have positive growth rates. So it's a good guess to expect that a repetitive pattern will be the new solution.
I agree. Can you prove stability of the? Can you actually find what the stable?
Not in this model. In others, you can. So
what does this dimensionless number mean?
Ooh, a dimensionless number, which?
Sigma star is a dimensionless number.
It's in sigma star is the critical extent of a of a cortical activity bubble.
Yeah, I understand that, but if I wanted to turn this to a real number, what would we say determines the width then?
Okay, let's.
It's just an abstract.
Yeah, now let's have it concrete, because we know we defined this as the difference in the total activity in the left and right eye. You can plug it in here and evaluate it.
Absolutely.
This is E, Euler's number. Okay, I'm sure. So let's assume A of R, the right eye and the left eye activity patterns are random patterns with statistical symmetries, translation invariant. They have correlation functions with them. So the correlation function of the left eye activity patterns averaged over the ensemble, the correlation function of the right eye activity patterns, the correlation function of left and right eye activity patterns, which is given here as an example. So this depends on the distance in retinal coordinates and tells you what is the statistics of coactivation of the left eye and the right eye at a given distance. Now this sigma star and the is a function of because it depends on the on these activity patterns averaged over the ensemble. It is a function of these correlation functions. And when the dust settles, you have this equation: the left eye correlation function, the right eye correlation function, minus twice the cross correlation function of left and right eye. And okay, so what does it mean? Let's discuss this example of squint. In squint, both eyes receive normal visual images, should have the same type of activity patterns, but this correlation between left and right eye is modified by the squint angle. Usually, you focus your eyes on the on an image, and they have fairly similar visual input. In squint, this is inhibited by whatever mechanism, and so we know that CLR, the correlation of left and right eye activity patterns, will be lower in squint, which means that the argument of the square root will be larger in squint. So squint means that the threshold for the critical size of activation domains for the induction of for the formation of ocular dominance columns is raised, such that already even larger activation domains will lead to the formation of a column pattern.
This is kind of a pretty complicated question, but I don't understand how you get, just dimensionally, how do you get millimeters out of this?
Millimeters.
Yeah, what is...
Okay, I had no millimeters to start with, so it's...
Where's the spatial scale? I don't understand. Like, is A...
Okay,
the units of A.
Of A? A is...
Well, A is inside there, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Okay, there should be constants that transform impulses per second into millimeters. And to find them, for example, by measuring sigma in the size of the area. So, but I mean, let's work with dimensionals.
I don't understand how you're getting spatial scale out of this, because it seems to have units of stimulus intensity in it, which is not... it's got A squared in it, which is stimulus.
Okay, so look at this. This is not equality.
The only other number there was E.
This is not an equality.
You took out E. So.
But you can. Am I, Sebastian, you can.
Over home derivation, it's C exactly.
It's in units of
sigma, right? Sigma had a left because it was the definition of X.
I think this is a point for later discussion, no?
Yeah, you should go over the whole.
I just don't have any notion of what it means because you're.
I mean, it's a very intuitive thing. I mean, if the activities of the two eyes is highly correlated, the neurons are forced to become binocular. If it's uncorrelated, so.
I understand this other statement right here that sigma star, we have some kind of ordering of the sigmas, but.
Isn't the length scale
the
exponential in this Gaussian?
Yeah.
Absolute.
So
I tell you, the length scale is the sigma in the Gaussian. So what?
Put it
by hand.
Is that right?
You have to measure
something. This is the ratio between the So this is in units of the interaction width. The sigma star right here
is relative.
Is relative to the interaction width.
No, it is the critical interaction width. These relations between the units come in because you have a finite retina with a density of activity. You have a finite cortex which sets the average magnification factor. Now this density of activity is related to a length scale by that. And my feeling is that we started out without dimensions to begin with, so I can't really answer it. But if you want to do it right with dimensions, you need to work with activity densities. So there's a relation between the activities. These activities are measured in impulses per time and square millimeter. And there will be constants that get you the time out of this.
Okay, let's ask it the other way. How does the scale of the interaction come into this? Is that
the scale of the interaction?
Is there still the sigma in?
Yeah, the sigma is a parameter of the model. If it is larger than this value.
Okay, right.
Okay, so.
Got it.
Okay. This lecture goes to 7 or to. To speed this up, let's jump into. Okay, no, it's not so far. This dependence suggests a simple explanation for this wavelength shift, which is okay. Let's for the moment assume that sigma is not a constant, but it's a slowly changing function of time. Then there may be some periods in development where the actual sigma is larger than the critical value, and the pattern will only form when the size of the range of connections and the size of activity domains become smaller than the critical value. Now, since in squint the critical value is larger, it will be hit more early on, and since the wavelength is proportional to the sigma at the point in time when the column pattern forms, this will also lead to the earlier emergence of a larger spaced pattern. And this is not perfectly out of the way, which is shown by this graph taken from a paper from Braunstedt and Hegelund. What they measured was the size of receptive fields in the visual cortex as a function of age. And during this early development, when ocular dominance counts might form in the cat, there's really a steep decrease in the size of receptive fields, and the size of receptive fields is just proportional to the size of activity domains. Another thing I would like to briefly. Yep.
This means that the lateral connections actually become more and more narrow.
There's also data by Larry Katz that shows that lateral connections, the central parts, the nearest neighbor part of lateral connections, are initially more widespread and then become more concentrated. But this decrease of the receptive field size has also a component that comes from the decrease in the retinal ganglion cell receptive fields. They are also time dependent, because the eye grows, they become smaller. But all these things should end up in larger activity domains.
Smaller.
Yeah. Smaller, sorry. Mm. Okay, now we took this a bit further, asking ourselves maybe this such a connection between wavelength and timing might be a more general principle. And the I should present this. And we found a way to in which it actually explains observed interspecies differences in the layout of the patterns. Now, what these are examples of archaeal dominance and orientation preference patterns obtained from monkey V1 and from cat era 17, and there are two striking differences. First of all, there's one of the patterns is more stripe-like in both cases, but it's not the same. In the monkey, the archaeal dominant system often looks very stripy. In the cat, it is rather the orientation preference columns that have a stripe-like appearance, whereas archaeal dominance columns in the cat are very patchy and disrupted. Pattern has been described as beaded bands at best, if there are any bands in here. Conversely, in the monkey, the orientation preference pattern, if you look at the activity distribution for a single orientation, is more patch-like and has no clear stripe pattern like in the cat. And for the cat, at least you immediately see that this has a smaller scale than the orientation preference pattern. So the in order to see whether how to explain this, of course, one has to look at a model that is can describe the concurrent development of archaeal dominance and orientation preference. So from a dynamics of this orientation field, O of X, we have to, we might generalize this to a coupled dynamics for a field that describes archaeal dominance and a field of complex numbers that describes the pattern of orientation preferences. So the simplest way to do this is just to form the analogous equation and couple them by requiring that, so this is the old rule for determining the activity center. Now also look at the difference of the orientation preference of the winning column to the to a stimulus parameter that describes the orientation of the of a stimulus.
So the interaction between them is still zero.
Yeah, the interaction they are uncoupled. Besides that, this activity bubble and this activity bubble have the same center, and both O and C determine where this center is.
So you can see here that there are no dimensions because we mix up orientation of the dominant.
Yeah, this. I mean, this is not biophysically realistic. Why should I have impulses per second in there?
Put dimension everywhere by inserting
stuff. I guess my question is, I don't understand exactly what stimulus properties that, you know, what are the stimulus properties that determine sigma star? I don't really have a good, I see the mathematical expression, but I don't see what, and besides the vague idea that it's correlations that cause it, but I don't have any precise understanding. I guess the same thing occurs in the Turing instability. You have to ask what is the, what are the critical ranges of parameters for which you get pattern formation?
Yeah.
And that depends on some diffusion constants or
exactly, yeah. That's diffusion constants. Here it is. I mean there are let's compare it to Bernard convection. There you have the force that drives up a high temperature bubble of liquids. And you have the diffusion, the heat diffusion that homogenizes the temperature, the temperature field. Here, the two forces is the weight decay that homogenizes the pattern, either of the weights or of the orchid dominances, and the Hapgood learning, which can only increase selectivities. And the critical point is where those are of equal strength.
So just break the correlation.
So the question is why is there this critical point? And the reason is that these two terms scale differently with the size of the domains. The weight decay scales with the amount of activity in the cortex, which goes like sigma square. The selective, the Hapgood part, goes with another power of sigma. In this model, it goes with sigma, it is independent of sigma. In a general model, it will have some power law dependence that has a different exponent, and that is why these two terms cancel at a critical point, and that for large sigmas, there's a lot of weight decay, and you can nail down any pattern, smooth it out. That's the physics. So I presented this. Okay, now in this coupled dynamics, we have a new thing. We have a formal orientation stimulus. As Micha said, the coupling is only through this rule to determine the winning neuron. And of course, because there are now two stimulus dimensions that may be mapped in a repetitive fashion, it comes with two critical values of the sigma. One that corresponds to the bifurcation of a orchid dominance column from a homogeneous state, one that corresponds to the bifurcation of an orientation column pattern from the homogeneous state, and in general, those two.
Homogeneous state in orientation.
It is circular symmetric receptive fields, for instance. The homogeneous state for.
You have input defined as this is a high dimension.
The Z of is a complex number, the phase of which determines describes the orientation of the stimulus.
So zero.
And we have this difference that makes the preferred orientation of the active neurons go towards the orientation of the stimulus presented.
So you present the oriented stimuli.
Yeah, oriented stimuli in both eyes and different compositions in the two eyes.
So the uniform map is when you...
The uniform map...
Always are zeros everywhere.
And Z are
zero.
Yeah. Which means all the neurons respond to all the orientations equally. Now with this, in this, because we add these dimensions, that there's no defined relation between the statistics of these O forces and the orientation forces, the critical values will in general be different. So there are two ways they might be different. Either the critical value for the orchid dominance field is larger than that for the orientation preference field, smaller. Or the other way around, such that, so assuming a decreasing range of interactions, in this case, first the orientation map will form and then an orchid dominance map. And here, the other way around, first an orchid dominance and then an orientation map will form. And so on. Fortunately, there are two studies in which, in individual animals, both the orchid dominance and the orientation pattern was obtained and the wavelengths calculated. And funny enough, in the cats, in every instance from this paper, reported in this paper, the orchid dominance column had the smaller wavelengths, and in all the monkeys, this is a paper by Obermeier and Blaisdell, the orchid dominance columns were always larger in wavelengths. So this allows one to identify this regime where the ocular dominance comes to form first and give rise to larger ocular dominance comes with the monkey case, and this where the orientation comes form first and accordingly have the larger wavelengths should, if anything, correspond with the cat case. So, but the major difference between those species was the layout.
Okay, so why is it that the order in which it happens determines which one is smaller? They're determined by different stimulus.
Yeah, but so this works only where, okay. That's the critical value that depends on stimulus statistics. The wavelength of the pattern that forms is proportional to the size of the activity domains, the range of interactions, at the point in time when the pattern will form. If sigma is not constant, but sharpens, this point in time will depend on the critical parameter, which itself depends on the correlations. And through this indirect mechanism, can correlations influence the wavelength? It also means that...
So you seem to think that
yeah?
the
physical
time, or...
Yeah, it's assumed here. Right. Yep. Which the, okay, you mean this?
Yeah.
This is not an orientation selectivity. Okay, there are different.
Okay. Okay, so it looks here that here orientation develops the before equilibrium.
Yeah, I drew it like this at that point in time. Yeah. I mean, it's still plausible. But the main point, and the thing I still believe very strongly, and which is a very simple measurement, is this is neither ocular dominance nor orientation preference, but the size of the discharge field. How large is the field? Is the part of visual space where you can elicit a strong response of the neurons? And this field decreases with time. That's the main point I want to make here, and the those weeks. So this is time in weeks, age in weeks, where there's a strong decrease coincides with the period where cones are either not observed and then observed. So it's likely to be the time when the cones really form. So, okay, making this simple generalization and noting that the critical values will need not be the same, so either one is larger or the other, you can only, there are two scenarios. Either the ocular dominance is the first come with the larger wavelength, or the orientation preference is the first come with the larger wavelength. And one should expect that this scenario corresponds to the cat because it has the cats exhibit this order of the column spacings, and the monkeys the reverse. But that does not show that actually the patterns will exhibit these typical layout differences, but they do. So these are two simulations of this model. Run with parameters that either make the orientation preference pattern first bifurcate, the ocular dominance column first bifurcate, and all with parameters such that the orientation preference column is the one that leads in development. and should accordingly develop into a cat-like or a monkey-like pattern. And okay, you will see let's look at these ocular dominance patterns that result from this from the dynamics. In fact, they look more stripe-like in the monkey and more patch-like in the cat-like simulation. Oh, this is not a monkey, this is the monkey scenario simulation. And the
you're saying there's, yep. There's not just a difference in scale, there's a difference in shape.
There's a difference in
if
shape.
If I shrank that down, it wouldn't look like that.
What?
If I just blew that up on the right, it wouldn't look like that.
Yeah. And the force that keeps it different is the interaction of the two patterns. To demonstrate this, let me show you a simulation that started with the same initial condition, which is a late phase of this cat-like simulation, and then we did two runs, one in the presence of this orientation preference map, and the other erasing the orientation preference map, cutting the interaction between the two systems. And in this second case, the initial patch-like, patchy-looking ocular dominance map rearranged into a more stripe-like structure, whereas it did not so in the presence of the orientation preference cones. And it's easily understood. I mean, both in the animal and in this model, there's this perpendicular interaction relation, intersection relation between the other orientation domains and the ocular dominance column. So this I showed you this in the experiment. It's also reproduced by the model. And when you imagine a situation where an orientation preference pattern has already formed, so has pinwheels with other orientation domains connecting these defects, and you have to draw an ocular a set of ocular dominance borders that respects this tendency of intersecting other orientation domains at right angles, you will typically end up with patches that encircle and enclose this pinwheel defect. So, which is consistent with this observation that when you remove the orientation column system artificially, the thing then relaxes into a stripe pattern. So this suggests that the interaction is what keeps it patch-like in the cat. So let's wrap up this part of the presentation. There's a few phenomena we can understand if we consider models in which these maps emerge by discrete instability-like events that occur during development. When these instabilities occur, the critical parameters depend on the experienced stimuli, on the statistics of the afferent activity patterns, as can be understood in this example of ocular dominance columns, and the instability is controlled by both the statistics of the stimuli and this intrinsic parameter, the size, which may be itself a changing time-dependent variable. And in these few cases I sketched to you, the wavelengths that are observed and the actual layout of the patterns can to some degree be explained by this sequential bifurcation mechanism that gives the general prediction that these column patterns should emerge in the order of their wavelengths. There's no way to set parameters such that the small scale patterns can form first, and which suggests that the pattern interactions play are essential for understanding these interspecies differences. So I think we make a short break here and then do something much simpler and
all right, we'll start again at 4.
Since it's already a bit late, I will skip some of the theoretical results I like most and instead go straight to discuss recent progress and recent surprises in the experimental study of visual cortical pattern formation. And so the impression I'd like to confer is that and that maybe as a surprise, since visual cortical pattern formation has been studied for like 30 years now, and one may expect that in this time and with the high caliber biologists treating this problem, the basic things such as nature versus nurture might be settled, but due to the intriguing nature of the brain, it has not worked out so far. So, okay, nature versus nurture is still an open question. If you find it interesting or not, we don't know the answer. Another point that became more and more intriguing and interesting is it's the following. Even if the structuring, the development of these patterns is due to learning mechanisms and is driven by activity and instructed by patterns of activity, this may not mean that experience is all that important for the structuring of the cortex, because there's quite a bit of evidence that also the young nervous system is capable to generate patterns of activity that can drive learning instead of or rather than experience driven activity patterns. Okay, that's the question of the role of the critical period and closely associated a mismatch of the time scales for these pattern-forming processes that has emerged recently and or sharpened at least recently. So let's get into this. One of the early experiments, 7 years old now, the publication that really astonished people was done by Tobias Bonhoeffer, who pioneered this technique of optical imaging together with his PhD student Imke Gödicke at that time. And what they did, once they could, and his wife now, once they had optical imaging running in the kitten, they tried to reproduce the one experiment which during the 70s and 80s produced the largest effect in orientation preference patterns. And the paradigm is called reverse suture. So what the people in the 80s and 70s did is a kitten opens his eyes about 2 weeks after birth. And the peak of the critical period, the time at which the synapses and the ocular dominance counts exhibit the largest degree of plasticity, is like 2 months, like 6 weeks to 2 months after birth. So the protocol that people thought induced the largest changes in orientation preference was to, at the time of natural eye opening, close one of the eyes of the kittens by surgery, such that until some time in the second month of life, it could only have active vision or normal vision with one eye. At that point in time, they reversed the situation and closed the previously open eye such that the kitten was forced to use the eye through which it had no visual experience up to that point. And what different researchers that pioneered this paradigm found in the 70s and 80s was that the neurons in the cortex of these animals had receptive fields in the two eyes, which often had different orientation preferences in the left eye and in the right eye. And they took this as a suggestion that, okay, clearly during this first phase, the open eye would take over the cortical territory almost completely, and then in the still very plastic period, the reopened eye would regain this territory, leading to a complete new formation of the orientation preference map. That was the common conclusion of several independent research groups in the 80s, and was obviously a very good choice for the first plasticity experiment to be performed with optical imaging, because only with optical imaging you can easily assess the entire layout.
When they did the recording, they opened both eyes now. When the recordings were made,
yeah,
they opened the second eye.
Yeah, at a late. In the adult animal, the second eye was opened, and then receptive fields through both eyes separately established. Now, with optical imaging, you can do two things that were not feasible in these experiments. One is to have a look at the eye at the map that is established first, and then again go into the same animal because it survives, and look at the late map that forms in response to the then open eye, and compare. And so this display shows you what they found. So this is an example of a kitten which would only see with its left eye until 34 days of age. Then Gödicke and Bonhoeffer measured this orientation preference map, and afterwards opened the previously closed right eye and closed the previously open left eye, and after another 2 weeks, looked again. Now this map is calculated by responses to the stimulation of the right eye, and this map is calculated from responses through stimulation of the left eye. And when they stimulated the right eye in this animal, they did not obtain any patterns of activity. And but you will realize that the two patterns are not at all completely different. In fact, the conclusions of these authors was that they are typically virtually identical, these two maps. And they already in their original publication, they discussed several possibilities. One was that there is some mechanism within the cortex that can keep a memory of an early orientation map and impose it on the newly forming orientation map in the second phase, or alternatively there might be what they called intrinsic factors, most extremely the genetic predetermination of the orientation preference of individual neurons. That may guide this development and program neurons to become selective for certain orientations, whatever their input is. Now, nobody can imagine what this mechanism is, but agnostic as biologists are, that's no reason to think that there is no such mechanism. Of course, a few things should also be taken, kept in mind. There's still the inconsistency with the old electrophysiological recordings, and there are two explanations for this, at least. First is the electrophysiologists of the 80s had the sampling bias and found the cells which fit their preconceptions. But the other is there might be a difference in the preparations. And the reason for that is that optical imaging can only be done for structures that are close to the surface of the brain. Now, most of Area 17, where almost all the classical studies of visual development have been performed, is hidden between the two hemispheres of the brain. So Gödicke and Bonhoeffer were forced to work in a different area. And the difference between these areas might be essential. So if you would flatten out the cat visual cortex on a plane, there's a large primary visual cortex called Area 17, and adjacent to it there's the second visual cortical area of the cat called Area 18, which is largely on the surface of the brain, and Area 17 is largely hidden between the two hemispheres. And this area, Area 18, is what is used in most optical imaging experiments, and one should keep in mind that it's only up to 3 millimeters wide, which is not very large when you consider that the distance between columns in Area 18 is larger than a millimeter, like 1.5 millimeters.
Yeah. How big is this area which we see here?
Yeah, it's almost... this is the side of the brain. This is towards the midline of the brain, I think. So the Area 18 is almost entirely contained within this. So this is a millimeter. We have 2 millimeters, maybe Area 18 ends here if it begins here. So this is the case of a system in which the size of the structures is not very different from the size of the system, at least in one direction. So one explanation is advocated at that point in time is based on this observation. When you run, in this case, a synaptic model for the formation of orientation columns, you get very different results if you run it, if you solve this dynamics in a large area or in a long and elongated area. And these are the outcomes of 4 simulations, all of them starting with this with orientation unselective homogeneous initial condition. Those two are in a quadratic and large area, and were produced with a different sequence of stimuli each. So we generated a random sequence of oriented contours, obtaining this pattern, then starting from the same initial condition, exposing the system to a different sequence of random oriented patterns, obtained this one, and you see that whereas they have certain, their statistical general layout is similar, the detailed structures in the patterns is not similar at all. There's no significant correlation between these two patterns. It's very different in the case of a small area. These were subject to the same different sequences of oriented input patterns, but nevertheless ended up in very similar with very similar maps in them, and correlation between the maps comparable to the one that is observed in the experiment. And the reason for this is that
What determines the sequence of colors?
What determines the sequence of colors?
Yeah, why you always get red?
Okay, the mechanism is it is an interaction between orientation preference and retinotopy. And the reason is, or the mechanism is in, I have these transparencies here. In these small areas 18 and 19 that are very elongated, also the retinotopy is discontinuous. There's what is called a field discontinuity. For example, prominently the horizontal meridian, or the vicinity of the horizontal meridian, is not topographically represented. But so the upper part of the visual field is represented in one part of area 18 and the lower part of the visual field in the other part, but such that if you move across the horizontal meridian, you run into the border and jump out there, and this is accompanied by other gross distortions of the retinotopy. Now there's in the model we considered, there's a coupling between the shape of the back projection of the aerial border. Maybe I have it here. So, yeah, I have it. Actually, this behavior is also mimicked by map formation models. That you can find an instability that produces these discontinuities. But so what is depicted here and is most telling in this respect is the positions of a raster of neurons that is equidistant in this elongated target area. And you see that there are folds and strong curvatures in this pattern of receptive fields. Now imagine that there's a tendency, for example, of orientation, the orientations of the individual receptive fields to be rather tangential to the border of the representation than to be orthogonal to the border of the representation. Such a folded retinotopy will induce a strong orientation bias for the individual things, and this makes for a very reproducible and almost unique attractor for this orientation column dynamics.
That's what is simulated,
we replaced this elliptic target area with a square or rectangular target area. You can't avoid them. If you have if you map the visual space into a small area, these distortions form spontaneously.
So you didn't simulate this low dimensional component.
We simulated the high dimensional, but it developed also this discontinuities in the retinotopy. And they, because they are large-scale structures, are largely set by the boundary conditions, and then provide a bias for the formation of orientations. Misha, who is asking, has proposed another very intriguing explanation of this result that is based on intrinsic connections and the randomness of intracortical connections. You may imagine that if you have a random wiring within the cortical sheath, not a perfectly translation invariant wiring, as in this case, the randomness of the wiring may induce certain orientation biases in the neurons, and because the origin of these biases is cortical, they will have the effect whether the information is fed in through one eye or the other. The difference between these two explanations is, of course, that we would expect that the old experiments were done correctly and reflect the fact that the same protocol can induce cross changes in area 17 because it is large and not dominated by boundary effects. but are incapable to induce a new map in area 70, in area 18, whereas if it is due to the randomness of intercortical connections, the experiment may have the same outcome in area 17 as well. What else? A few years later, there was another experiment done by Mike Creer and Mike Stryker in San Francisco, which raised and supported yet another explanation for this observation. And what they did was to compare the formation of maps of orientation maps in normal-sided cats to the formation of orientation maps in binocularly deprived cats. And so when one assumes, would one assume that the formation of these patterns is driven really by visual experience, one should expect somewhat different time course for the formation of orientation columns in cats that have no visual input or very reduced visual input because they have closed eyes, and cats that can actually see through their eyes. Now, these are two typical examples of those measurements, and you don't see cross differences. And when they looked in quantitatively and resolved this as a function of time during development, what they found is that in comparing binocular deprived and normal animals, there's an early phase. They found an early phase, like up to 2 to 3 weeks, where the way in which the selectivity increased was almost indistinguishable between the animals that had no visual experience, normal, and the animals that had the usual visual experience of a young cat. And in addition, they investigated the similarity of the maps in the two eyes, of the two eyes maps in the two raising conditions, because if you have the hypothesis that the matching of the orientation preferences in the two eyes receptive fields is due to the fact that the two eyes look at the same images and are driven by very similar stimuli, one may expect that in the binocularly deprived animal that has fairly uncorrelated, if any activity patterns at all, this similarity might not be established. Nevertheless, the similarity between the left and the right eye maps increased in this early phase and increased irrespective of the rearing paradigm. There are other things that are dependent on the visual experience. One of the things they found was that in the early cortex, so this is the y-axis, tells you the selectivity. Here in the solid line, the selectivity for stimuli presented to the contralateral eye, and the broken line for the ipsilateral eye. And what they consistently found is that the early cortex is very much more strongly driven by the contralateral eye, and only later do the responses in response to stimulation of both eyes become equal. And this equalization is very much dependent on the nature of experience, but it happens at a much later time. So these experiments suggested that a third explanation of the Goetheke and Bonhoeffer experiment, which is that whatever mechanism drives, is behind this early formation of the first orientation preference pattern, is capable of producing a similar map in both eyes. And then what a monocular deprivation experiment can do is to reduce one of them and to make it grow again. One of the conclusions Creer and Stryker and I think Gillespie drew from this was that they found this suggests that visual experience does not play any role in the determination of the layout of the columns. It may have a role in the determination of the degree of selectivity, but only at a very late age. Now there's another stream of observations that is in line with this. And this is investigations of the spontaneous activity in the peripheral stages of the visual pathway. The first such observation was, I think, made by Italian researchers, Maffei. They, in a technically very demanding experiment, managed to record the activity of ganglion cells in fetal rats. So they prepared, they retrieved a fetus from the womb of a rat mother, and were able to measure the spike frames from retinal ganglion cell in these pups. And the weird thing is that at that point in development, the retina don't even have photoreceptors. So the ganglion cells are the first cells to form in the retina, and had already begun to send connections to the brain, and had already were already producing activity patterns that were correlated between neighboring neurons and had spatial and temporal structure. Now, subsequent to this, spontaneous activity has been very well documented in the retina and has begun to be studied in the LGN. And one of the most recent contributions of this comes from the lab of Larry Kass, work done by Mike Wellicke. What he did was to chronically implant a multi-electrode array in the LGN of ferrets. And then determine the receptive field type of these cells, whether they are on and off, whether they prefer the ipsilateral or the contralateral eye. And subsequently, in the behaving animal, study the correlations that occur either with sight, without eyes, with eyes, and found that irrespective of the conditions, even in animals that had their eyes removed, there was a high degree of correlation among different LGN units. And one can easily imagine that such spontaneously generated activity patterns that are correlated among the different eye layers in the LGN may induce the formation of a similar orientation preference map in the both eye channels, pathways. There's also experimental theoretical work that supports this. Ken Miller has extensively studied Hebbian models, correlation-based Hebbian models for these projections of different center types onto a cortical layer, and finds only very gross qualitative restrictions on the kind of correlations that have to occur in these spontaneously generated activity patterns, such that cortical neurons develop orientation preference and some pattern of orientation preferences across cortex. So much of this evidence is taken as indicating that if learning mechanisms underlie cortical pattern formation, rather spontaneously generated activity patterns may drive the structuring, and only at a late stage, be it that visually driven and visually made experience contributes to this. Another phenomenon that gave some hope to find aspects of visual development that are clearly related to experience is the representation of the different orientations. It is obvious, probably, that in our visual world, not all the orientations occur with the same frequency. Now, when you look around in this building, there are a few oblique contours around, but most of the contours you can discern are of the cardinal orientation, being either horizontal, there's a lot of horizontal in here, and also a few vertical contours. And when Coppola et al., Dale Perfs, Fitzpatrick, I think, quantitatively looked at different sets of natural scenes, either taken indoor at Duke University, outdoor at Duke University, or in the surrounding woods, and histogrammed the occurrence of contour elements with different orientations, they found a clear-cut overabundance of the horizontal and vertical orientations that was present also in the woods, not as clearly expressed as in these human-generated environments, but in general there. Yeah. There's always this question: how you view the world, right? But so what they found in the companion paper is that in fact, in the ferret visual cortex, they looked at adult ferrets. They found examples where indeed a larger amount of cortical territory was occupied by the columns that code for the vertical and horizontal orientations than for the two oblique orientations, which raised the question whether so this obvious adaptation of the how labor is distributed among cortical cells to the statistics and structure of natural scenes may be acquired in the learning process. In another paper that appeared in the same issue of PNAS, Chapman and Bonhoeffer observed basically the same effect but resolved the development. And weird enough, they found first of all, that this overrepresentation of the cardinal orientation was present very early at a time where these other evidences indicate very little influence for visual experience. And in fact, if you look over the time course, it is rather that the degree of overrepresentation decreases than that it increases. And this so decrease of the overrepresentation of the cardinal orientations with age was recently confirmed by the Fitzpatrick group. So it is really the other way around than one would expect. So if you learn from such images, you may go from a homogeneous, unbiased towards a overrepresented structure of your visual cortex. However, the real thing goes in the other direction. It homogenizes rather than inhomogenizes the representational fractions. Evidence that is observations that go that are taken to indicate a totally different scheme have occurred in investigations of the formation of ocular dominance columns. I told you about this piece of data before. The classical view of the formation of ocular dominance columns from a homogeneous pattern early in development through a gradual sharpening that takes many weeks, even months, to reach its full extent. These observations were obtained with transneuronal labeling by proline, so a tracer was injected in one eye, and what people visualized, LeVay, Schatz, and Stryker, was the amount of proline that was finally transported into layer 4 of the visual cortex. And there was always the concern that if the spillover, the diffusion of the tracer decreases with time, even with a pattern present at the early date, at the early age, the homogeneous labeling may be produced by the diffusion of the tracer rather than by the diffusiveness of the projection. Now, Crawley and Katz recently explored a different way to visualize the clustering of eye-specific geniculocortical connections. What they did was to inject a tracer biocytin directly into the LGN and to reconstruct the terminal arbors of the injected neurons, which is a much more precise method. And to their own surprise, as I meanwhile think, they found that at an age where the LGN neurons have just arrived in the cortical plate, they can also already visualize termination patterns that look very much similar to the adult organization of ocular dominance columns in these animals. This is also in line with evidence from monkeys where, yeah. The transneural labeling, the right-hand side image, there proline, radioactively labeled proline, is injected into the eye, and this is by axonal transport gets into the LGN, then by a miraculous process is transferred to the postsynaptic cells, and they themselves axonally transport the tracer to the cortex. Yeah, it is global on the retina. All the axons are labeled in a sense. Whereas this is a local technique. This is an injection of the tracer in the LGN, not in the eye, and in only a small part of the LGN. But, so what they did is they want to label neurons in an individual eye selective layer of the LGN. And I think they really succeed in doing this. So I should point out that this is also an unfair comparison. I mean, this is an observation from cats, and this is an observation of ferrets. So there may, in addition, be a species difference. But again, the other way around, meanwhile, people are reinvestigating ocular dominance conformation in the cat and find similar early patterns at about the time of eye opening, not as early as in the ferret, but much earlier than was previously thought. And this is what I would like to call a mismatch of the timescales that has emerged through this experience. I mean, recall that the critical period, the period during which the synapses are most changeable and also the column patterns have been most easily manipulated experimentally, starts at the earliest, at the point of eye opening, and then goes for weeks and months. Now, previously, in the light of this evidence and its classical interpretation, people thought that this matched very well. The period during which there's evidence for the largest plasticity is also the period during which the structures are built. Now, first with the orientation preference system, and now also with the ocular dominance, which was the classical Paradebeispiel of such a process, the emergence has shifted towards an age where there might be plastic synapses and all the mechanisms present, but even if the structures form at this very early stages by learning mechanisms, what the heck is the sense of this long plasticity period? We don't know anymore what the functional role of this critical period is. Now, I said when I discussed these Bonhoeffer experiments, the reverse suture experiments, that at that point, really also the hypothesis rekindled that genetic information may have a instructional role in specifying and programming cortical neurons to become selective to certain orientations. Now the final test for that is still out, but one thing could be done with the data is already has been obtained, and it is okay, the final test will require to record, to demonstrate these maps in genetically identical individuals, like clones or twins. And the hope of the nature team, of course, is to find in identical animals raised with different experience identical maps. Now, if there's a strong role of genetic information in specifying these column patterns, it may already show up in sisters and brothers in plain littermates. So to test this hypothesis, what we did is the thesis of work of Matthias Kaschube, who is here. We analyzed a large set of orientation column patterns obtained from cats, like 50 hemispheres from almost 40 animals, which had a large number of littermates in them. And then, so these are examples from this data set. This is cat L15 in the left cortex and cat L17 in the left cortex, and they have the same mother, and these are two sea cats with the same mother, so you can judge whether these patterns are similar or not. What we did was to quantify their structure, obtaining parameters that describe the size of the columns, the homogeneity of the column sizes throughout the area, the shape of the columns, whether they are more band-like or more patch-like. And for all of these parameters, what Matthias found was that the real litters are much more similar to one another, the real littermates, than what one has to predict if the layout parameters of the columns are statistically independent. Were statistically independent in the...
So the littermates are more alike than looking at non-littermates?
Yeah.
And you know anything about the non-littermates? Do you know what the tree was? The family tree?
The family tree? No, we can't reconstruct beyond mother-child relations.
I mean, it seems like a totally useless experiment. Somebody could argue with the temperature of the mom.
Tell me, what?
Somebody could argue that there was a temperature, there was that detailed temperature of the womb and the mom.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, if the result would be different,
negative.
Okay.
Would be more.
Yeah. Okay, but there are other factors that may explain this besides genetic information. I agree. But okay, you can start to exclude them. So for example, one thing that argues against such gross factors is that, what did we look at? Additional variables, the weight of the animal, the size of the brain, for example, they are not clustered among littermates in this data set. So it is not a general mechanism of common intrauterine environment or very general genetic factors that plays a role here. So the things that are clustered are really the variables that are sensitive for the pattern layouts and not the general physiological variables which we have in the data set. But you're right, it's not a... I would argue that it's not a perfectly useless experiment, but it's not the perfect experiment. What else? Okay, but there's also good news. I shouldn't take sides here. There's also intriguing evidence for self-organization origin of cortical maps, and it comes from work that has been pursued for a long time in the lab of Regan-Kar Suhr. They have perfectioned or developed to as good as this seems to be feasible, a preparation in which they redirect the input of the visual system into the auditory cortex. And as far as I understand, what they do is to remove the visual thalamus in a very young animal. And what happens in response to that is that the axons from the eye that would usually terminate in the lateral geniculate nucleus and project into the visual cortex pass by that structure and invade the nucleus of the thalamus that provides the input to the auditory cortex. I think they have also to de-afferentiate the auditory thalamus in order for this to work out. But they managed to grow animals, ferrets, in which the what should be the auditory cortex receives input from the visual system. And if the representations that form are basically driven by the kind of input that is fed into a cortical area, one might expect or one might predict, or hopefully wish to find, that in an auditory cortex that is fed in visual information, the column structures and maps that form should be more like visual cortical columns. And so in a recent series of experiments, they actually managed to obtain orientation preference maps from auditory cortices of rewired ferrets and compared them somewhat quantitatively and qualitatively to orientation preference maps in the actual visual cortex of columns. And you see here this example, which shows that there's some gross. So first of all, there's an orientation preference map in the auditory cortex of the ferrets after they have been treated by these researchers. And in addition, some key features of the visual cortical maps are reproduced by this artificially visualized auditory cortex. So this is evidence that is, I think, very well in line with the concept that the cortex can generate the appropriate data and column structures independent on the kind of information that's fed in. So, okay. I'd like to stop here and start the terminal phase of this presentation by wrapping up the things we understand well and not so well about the models of cortical pattern formation and the development of experiment that has occurred during the last few years. Now, in general, as I said, in my opinion, these whatever the mechanisms are, the one thing that has become very obscure is the significance of the critical phase plasticity. Because previously, when people thought that column formation took place during this week and month long period of plasticity, it was very plausible to assume that one of the uses of the developmental plasticity was the establishment of the column structures. Now that's not longer, one cannot stand to this view anymore. In general, also the nature-nurture issue is qualitatively open. We have no evidence in which direction ever to exclude the extremes. The complete genetic determination of the cortical selectivities is conceivable, and the all overwhelming role of learning mechanisms is as conceivable with the evidence that is at our hands. Now, okay, there are different things that I think are very challenging in experiment and theory for physicists and experimental and theoretical in brain research, but maybe we should just start the discussion at that point, and I can feed in my opinions as fit. What?
With no bias, with experiment, you say, what, instead of have this list here, what do you think are the best experiment, most critical experiments? Experiments with the most impact that could be done?
In my opinion, the one point I would have liked to discuss is the question whether the current patterns after their initial formation may undergo rearrangement during the critical phase for plasticity. There's the general statement by the majority of the papers, which are all authored by one group, that there's no such change. But the basic finding there is that if there is a systematic maturation and rearrangement of the map layout, it is not of a all or nothing nature, but it's a subtle optimization process. Now, at this point in time, intrinsic imaging is not good enough in terms of signal to noise to distinguish random variations in the signal from fine but progressive rearrangements of the columns. So one thing that I find that I really would like to see is to have a chronic imaging or assessment technique, must not be optical imaging, that has a good fidelity in detecting orientation preferences or whatever similar selectivity features you like. Because all the models I have looked at so far don't have this initial emergence of a column pattern that then stays fixed. When you do the simulations right and run the model for a time that is much longer than it takes to establish the columns, I don't know a single example in which there are not progressive rearrangements of the columns that will eventually, over quite a while, substantially change the pattern. And this is my...
You want to look into the tail of the formation of the map.
And this is this is really a qualitative point, because if these early maps are largely dominated by the random initial conditions, whatever mechanism you suppose. Now, if we think that, I mean, this structure is reworked and rebuilt for a few months. Synapses removed and tested and consolidated or tried again. It is a qualitatively important qualitative issue whether the structures that are there in the adult animal are optimized or whether they are just random and the brain does not care about it. Now, if there is no long-term reorganization of the patterns, I don't see a chance for these column structures to be optimized in whatever respect. So to do the chronic recordings right is one of the key things. And I would strongly advise people to take the chronic studies that have been performed with a huge grain of salt. They show that the columns in 2 days will be very similar to the columns today, but whether there are systematic and progressive the arrangements is not clear at all.
So I just have a technical question. Mm-hmm. You may have said it when I had to duck out. So the blood vessels on the surface rearrange themselves. This is not. But when people make maps, mm-hmm. is it relative? The fiducials are things that are not the blood vessels. What do you use as fiducials? It's kind of critical. When you test for the time dependence of the map.
They test. So in order to align those patterns obtained at different ages, what is done is to calculate shifted cross correlations and to perform a linear translation of the pattern such that you have the maximum overlap, which is putting in a bit of the result then. So they compare the maps that are most similar. One could easily introduce a label, for example, inject some fluorescent beads in at 3 points and make those points coincide, but that's not the way these studies were performed. Yeah. Another riddle that points into the necessity that these columns don't stay put is brain growth. I mean, it's not discussed in any of those papers, but the at the age between the adult animal and the age where the first columns are there, the size of the visual cortex is increased by 50%. However, the typical distance, the wavelength of the pattern, is almost the adult value, or is indistinguishable from the adult value. So this is another.
It's a conflict.
Yeah, this is a conflict. So the pattern cannot stay put. Yet it has not been observed to change.
So it's part of the same experiment, you know, in a way. Just make a window that's a lycra window that stretches.
Yeah, sorry, I interrupted you.
So, talking about the orientation map, well, orientation maps in different species, they have very different looking appearance, right? So in rodents, there is a salt and pepper, and the map is intermixed, and then there's this lineage effect, right? Some of the species have lineage effects, some of them, like ferrets, don't have lineage, they have fractures, and monkeys and cats, and then they have growth fractures and pinwheels. So can those models based on learning rules, can they, what is the way to account for differences between species? Is there like parameter which you can vary and like switch from one map to another?
The longer you study these models, the more mechanisms you come up with. There are simple rules. For, I don't know whether you attended the previous part of the session. For example, the parameters that determine the bifurcation points of the different patterns have a systematic impact on the pattern layout. You can influence the density of the defects, the presence and absence of fractures, the general layout of the ocular dominance columns by just shifting the point in time at which the different patterns bifurcate. That's a simple scheme I like, but I'm sure there are a lot of other schemes that can explain species differences. So.
Well, I thought that you by changing this threshold, you change the periodicity.
Yeah.
Can it change the character?
No, okay. In these models, there's a. You cannot change the one without the other. There's a one-to-one relationship between patterns and wavelength orders. David. Another fun experiment that would be great, I think, would be to have an experimentally much better controlled model for map formation. Like go away from these complicated mammals and have orientation maps in tadpoles. If all the ingredients are there to produce them, just the and And we know that you can have.
Is there an orientation map in the tectum for
no.
tectals? Then
no.
Then how?
Okay, you can optically stimulate the tadpole in an immobilized preparation, and then experimentally control the actual stimulus ensemble and try to twitch the stimuli and the correlations of the afferent activity pattern such that in the direction in which all these models predict, one should twitch them in order to induce the bifurcation.
So there's a guy in Berkeley now who's trying to do this.
Yeah, at moving pool, Florian Eggert.
Florian, yeah.
Yeah, I find this very cool. Intriguing. It would be great if it worked out, because we will never achieve control of the stimulus ensemble in the mammalian preparation. There are all these sources of spontaneous activity that are good for the brain, but make the experiments so hard to interpret.
So I wanted to ask about the development of the projections from retina to
LGN. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's known about, are there molecular markers involved in establishing retinotopy there?
It seems that I recently was at a meeting where people presented evidence for that scheme. I think they believe it's afferents, and so what they showed were LGNs in afferent knockout mice and normal mice, and intriguingly the space map in the LGN was shifted.
Knockout
of afferent.
Afferent.
Knockout of afferent. Yeah. Afferent. So afferent A, or I don't know the nomenclature. So the retinotopy was disorganized as far as I understood, but the eye-specific layers still did form. And there's one guy in Munich, in Bonhoeffer's department, who looked at retinotopy in the visual cortex of afferent knockout mice. And there they see very little effect of the afferent knockout.
So if there's a molecular marker for retinotopy development in the cortex, nobody knows.
Yeah, it's not afferent.
No, not afferent.
Yeah.
But it'd be very interesting to know whether.
But what decreases is the match between the two eye. Oh, is this right? No, I'm not sure about this.
But it would be interesting to know whether the layering in the LGN has anything to do with the molecular.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And it could be the afferent. So the hypothesis was that also the layering could be the afferent because. So if there's a gradient from nasal to temporal retina, people think, and this could easily also distinguish the two eye layers because the ipsilateral area is a projection from temporal retina and the contralateral layer is a projection from the nasal retina. So if there are those gradients in the eyes, they could also guide the formation of the eye-specific layers. But even in the afferent knockout mice, which have this disrupted retinotopy, the eye-specific layers or structures at least form well and look very normal.
But no one has the idea of just a different molecule for each stripe, for each layer.
Of course, that's the next idea that people come up with.
Like in Drosophila, if you look at pattern formation in Drosophila embryo, uh-huh. Basically there's a lot of different molecules for each stripe,
uh-huh.
And that's one of the first places where the Turing instability was proposed.
Proposed,
but uh-huh. In fact, it turned out to be a different label for each stripe. So
I mean, these mechanisms may still come back there may be Turing instabilities of gene regulation interaction dynamics. In the olfactory system, there is this discussion that. The receptors, the molecular receptors in the olfactory system have this huge multiplicity of splicing and molecular forms. And there the people try to nail down the hypothesis that these receptor molecules are actually the guidance cues as well, because they have as much molecules as there are receptors almost.
Yeah, you see the same receptor off in the axon terminals.
Mm-hmm.
Surprising results there.
Yeah, more questions.
I just have a general question, not just for you, but for anybody working in neuroscience. Through this workshop, we've been hearing a lot of experiments in vision. Is it that people are not doing too much work in auditory processing, or it's difficult, or just today you've mentioned a couple of examples of in that. So, David is asking, and he's like, I'm just curious about it.
Why auditory? Why not auditory?
Oh,
sorry.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah. Why is the focus on visual system?
Are you sick of vision? Yeah. Is that what you're telling us?
It's spatial. Yeah, it's spatial. Why collage, straight path, bell bottom?
You're saying it's arbitrary.
I mean, historically there were two schools. There was the Mountcastle school, which had this wonderful paradigm, as you sort of hinted at with Mike Mirzak's experiment with tapping on a finger and looking at map formations, and then there's Hugo Wiesel. And Mountcastle's papers are actually kind of deep. He talks about timing and fidelity of the spike tree, everything that's come back and is fashionable now. But the papers are almost unreadable. Okay, I mean, it's hard to get through a paper here without a couple glasses of wine and margarita. Cool. And the Hugo Wiesel papers are much more accessible. There's no dynamics.
No.
I think it just took over the field.
No, I think there's another reason. So if you want to study plasticity of maps, you want to...
Not just maps, but anywhere. Like at the end of 2 weeks, I think almost certainly you say that one of the best similarities in vision are all along the rod, vertical rods, orientation and stuff. But if I was wanted to study audition, Right now,
let me just continue with the example of maps. If you want to study plasticity of maps, it helps to study a map that's kind of well understood. But if you look at the auditory system, nobody can figure out what the map is. Supposedly there's this tonotopy, this best frequency gradation in auditory cortex. Nobody knows really what's in the other direction.
Well, there's claims.
There's claims, all kinds of claims. But supposedly, you know, the map is just much more unclear. Whereas in the somatosensory system, you've got the homunculus. In the visual system, you've got all these nice maps here. So that's why people study the plasticity of these maps. But an auditory system is just up for grabs. Nobody knows.
Yeah, but I mean that's the effect also.
Sort of being and a first for things that we should try and kind of look at things
in the auditory system. Yeah, maybe. I mean, I know that for a number of years at UCSF, all the postdocs wanted to study the auditory system. So, you know, you could regard that as an opportunity.
I think I'm saying that because I'm working with auditory neurons, but I know not enough.
Feedback on that, or being able to talk to
enough. So I'm just curious whether it was just like there's more work available in this, or.
Like, has anyone tried imaging?
Oh, lots.
Imaging to study
auditory neurons? Lots, yeah. But
are there nice results? Or?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's sort of like Sebastian said. I mean, there's one school about what this perpendicular axis is. It's a sort of modulation of frequency that you have shot on.
Yeah.
But I don't know if they.
I mean, another reason for this popularity of the visual maps is that the optical imaging does not work that well in these other preparations, right? I mean, friends of me are trying to use optical imaging in the auditory cortex, and they find that almost every stimulus turns all of the area, just one blob of activity, no structure.
There's a paper written in 1975 by Moshe Ablos. It's actually a very useful paper mm-hmm. to read because he, you know, motivated by Hugo Wiesel, went ahead and started looking at auditory cortex. And actually, one of his postdocs now, a professor at Dawson, still keeps this up. But what he found is that he moved his electrode, he would occasionally find, you know, some cells. Which we selected those cells, we did this tonotopic map. But most cells did not get a tonotopic map. So he kind of didn't like the idea of maps. But he got kind of afraid of all the social pressures, right? So he went off to some very high level area.
Well, yeah, so he said he thinks it's baloney. So he's the people who studied the auditory cortex, they basically copied the vision people and said, well, let's look for maps in the auditory cortex. And they published a lot of papers saying, yeah, we find this nice tonotopy. And then there are heretics like Moshe Obelos who say it's all baloney. If you really record there, then the map is not really...
So the precious in line of view.
Yeah. So, I don't know, you can call it sociology because he left the field. But, I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's a need critical mass of people, right? You know, one person is the rather here.
I have a somewhat related question. I got an impression that, that as far as, say, formulated as imitation of human vision or audition goes, I got an impression that systems of, say, voice recognition, stuff like that, are much better developed, much closer to what humans can do nowadays than visual computer vision systems. Is that true?
So automatic speech recognition versus machine vision.
You want
to compare automatic speech recognition versus machine vision.
Yeah, because it seems to me that automatic speech recognition is much closer to what we can do, and then vision is so far away from actual human performance that makes people more curious about how we do it in the end.
I think speech recognition is just a small part of the theoretical process. For one, supposing you're listening to music, you can listen to it and make out features that the animal will be harder than it should be too. But it's very difficult to make a computer do that. And everybody developed along that. Disentangling different sounds from each other seems to be given a sounds that they do. I mean, if you're talking in somebody else's problem, you're the same sound, but I can make out.
I've heard a series of how birds. They recognize not only the tone, but the, by the kind of flavor of sound, which is not like who pronounced the sound, who is something else. So I don't know enough, but I got an impression that it's, you know, pretty much clear how we do, and there is less mystery.
But character recognition also is fairly important. Also, it seems to me that sound should be easy to find out there, so it's not that. I mean, vision is a much more complex thing. But still,
you're asking if we understand. If it's really true that we understand how the brain does vision better than we understand how it does audition, then our artificial systems for vision should be better. Is that what you're at? Is that the point you're making?
No, that's wrong. It's like that if we are able to make voice recognition systems better than we are able to make computer vision systems, then it makes us more curious about computer vision because we are further from what nature has.
Right. So I guess so you're bringing up the point that it's not clear what the fair comparison is, right? Because as you said, handwriting is another form of human communication, and computer vision systems. We'd have to ask whether the artificial systems for handwriting recognition are better or worse than for speech. It's difficult to say. But there is one issue about speech, which is that one issue about vision, which is that it's just. Is sheer computational power. So if you actually try writing programs for machine vision, one of the big problems is just doing all those operations on the pixels. So there's a computational bottleneck involved. So people have in the past utilized only very simple algorithms for vision. If you want to do real-time vision problems, often you're limited in the use of a very simple algorithm, not because you can't think of anything better, but because your computer can't work fast enough. I don't know if that's really a satisfactory answer, but that is one. When you start doing machine vision problems, that is one thing that clearly strikes you, is how much computational horsepower it takes. And to a large extent, the recent advances in automatic speech recognition have not come from any fundamental changes in algorithms. Algorithms were invented in the 70s, but it's simply because computers got faster.
Thank you. software available to improve images that we have already done from the audience to the audio, suppose you have a simple word that can be done with the audio. I mean, there are things you can mentally imagine how it would have to be ready for the audio. But today's processing technology can remove these scratches and that's all the data. I mean, is there some research going on in the process of the audio?
I don't know, but you mean for noise reduction, you know, smart noise reduction? Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, what kind of image things can you do besides, say, deconvolution, like the Hubble Space Telescope? What application are you talking about?
I'm talking about improving the sound of the instruments, making these instruments out, showing the